Yeah, good. Lots of people here. So we're really looking forward to hearing from them and to hearing from you and to hearing from our guests as well. And our guest, Art Odie, is former chair of Bayfield and Bloom, a horticulture landscaper and expert in botanical gardens and arboretums. He's one of our guests today. Art, welcome.
Thank you. And happy birthday, Larry.
Oh, yeah. I got to tell you, I've got some great gifts already today. We have Tekla, one of the little girls from this area, made me a nice little gift today. She's done every year. And I have some walking sticks that a friend of Wisconsin Public Radio made for my daughter and my wife. And Joanne Collins and the gang at the Ashland Bayfield County Master Gardeners have another wonderful birthday card for me. You know, last year's actually took the photo or the picture that Joanne painted, and it's hanging up in our kitchen right now, framed and hanging up in the kitchen. So this one will probably join it. It's great fun to be here every year. This is my seventh year here. This is the seventh celebration kicking off the weekend of Bayfield and Bloom, so it's a lot of fun for me to be here with Art Odie. And also, Don Kissinger of Wausau, the West Central Regional Urban Forestry Coordinator for the Department of Natural Resources. Don, welcome back.
Thank you, Larry.
Good to have you with us. And Jason Fishbach. Hi, Jason. Jason is the Ashland Bayfield County Extension Ag Horticulture Agent. Is that the way you do it, or is it ag, just straight ag? But I know you're horticulture.
Yeah, ag and horticulture.
Ag and horticulture. Okay, so three guests. I can't imagine a question relating to the outdoors, the garden, the lawn, the trees that these guys couldn't answer. I'd almost bet money on it. What do you think, Art?
Don't bet too much.
I tell you what, you can join us with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your gardening questions. I already have somebody online. And also, I'm certainly looking forward to hearing from members of the audience. So if you have a question, just raise your hand. John Munson's got the microphone in hand, and he will come around, and we'll get your question right here in the studio as well. So thank you so much. And I tell you what, let me turn to Jason first. Jason, overall, what are the conditions like in this area of the state right now for growing?
So far, so good. We've had enough moisture. We could use some more, but we're kind of nervous. If you saw the forecast for Saturday night, the low temperature is somewhere around 25. Right now, I was up in the orchards this morning, and we're at what we call a tight cluster, almost starting to bloom. And if those blooms open today and we get that cold weather, that's not so great.
But that's not
other
so
than
good.
That, we're ahead of schedule from last year. If you remember, last year was one of our latest blooms ever. But right now, it's gorgeous up there, sunny and no wind, and birds are singing. It's great.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, the daffodils and the tulips in this town. Art Odie, did you plant all those yourself? Or
No, not myself. But we've had plenty of good help. That's a Chamber of Commerce project. And I've kind of directed it over the years, but we get good help. I think we planted 35, maybe 40,000 so far. And we're going to keep right on going.
Well, there's acres. I mean, it's just absolutely gorgeous as you enter the city.
We tried to make them last for your birthday, but they're just getting over the hill.
Oh, they look pretty good to me. Yeah, they look pretty good to me. Yesterday was my birthday, so, you know, they were still pretty nice yesterday. Tell you what, we have some callers online, and we'll be talking a little bit about some of the events going on with Bayfield and Bloom as we go through the program today. But certainly we want to answer your questions as well. And I know we have a caller online from Nina, Greg. Let's go to Gregory. Greg, hi. Thank you for calling. Greg, are you there? Uh-oh.
Hello?
Hi, Greg. Thanks for calling.
Good morning to you up north. For the last 5 years, I've become so disappointed that I'm not attracting any type of very large butterflies, sphinx moth, hummingbirds, bees. It just seems like the insects are just not around anymore.
Well, what do you have out in your lawn?
Right now, clover, and I was looking at, like, some hyssop later on, tried to attract them with morning glories, hibiscus, but over the past 5 years, there's just hasn't been anything, except later on in the fall, the monarchs coming through.
Well, yeah, there might be some other things. Art, what do you think? There might be some other things you could be doing.
Well, any flowers that have a tubular flower are very attractive, as well as almost any colorful garden is going to attract hummingbirds and butterflies and skippers and things. I would kind of look around, see whether there's some environmental factor that might be specific to your location. Have you been using any kind of pesticides or herbicides that might be interfering with things?
No, personally not. It's a very old neighborhood, and it just seems like they've just disappeared. There's no.
Are you located in town or
in town in a wooded area? Well, kind of a wooded, shaded area. But I mean, like 10 years ago, we just had a huge amount of birds or hummingbirds and the you know larger butterflies. But just over the past 5 years, they just seem to have disappeared. And
well,
I didn't
could
know
be
it was migration or something.
No, I doubt that. It's probably there may be some other environmental factors that are going on in your community. So take not only a look at your own backyard, but take a look at the neighbors and the area, because maybe there, Jason, maybe there's some other things going on here.
Sure. Yeah, I get this question fairly often. You know, why don't I see these things that we want to see? And what I say is, okay, you and your neighbors get together, and the key is you want to get as much of a floral display as you can in your yard and your neighbor's yard. And I would start with big flowering crabapple trees, any of the fruit trees that have a huge profusion of flowers in the spring. And then you just have to work through your guidebooks and other things and try to find the right mix of flowers. You know, there are specific varieties and cultivars and species that are specific or do a better job attracting hummingbirds, for example. But the main thing is just a big diversity of flowers, both in species and in time. So as much floral display as you can get in your yard and your neighbors, the better. And you're going to start seeing things start showing up that you probably haven't seen before.
Yeah.
You know, I had another thought here, too. Butterflies particularly want to have a moisture source and a source of organic salts. And they like to have a gravel area that's wet that they can light on. So you might look at up here we certainly haven't had any kind of noticeable decrease in these kinds of activities.
Yeah.
So I would think it's something environmental.
Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling, Greg. Appreciate your call. Let's take a question from the audience. Hi.
Yes, my question is to do with when you're doing a total renovation of, say, a perennial bed, and you've got a lot of beautiful bulbs that you normally plant in the fall, but you're digging the whole bed out. I've tried different methods of holding those bulbs over till fall to put them back in the ground, but haven't had a lot of success with that. And a lot of people do ask me questions about, are you better off just to get rid of those bulbs and put new ones in the fall? Save them, and what would be the best method to kind of preserve them until you want to replant them?
Well, I'd start by saying that you're a very brave lady if you're actually completely redoing a perennial garden, because I need to redo mine and I never get around to it. but definitely save those bulbs, and I would try to just replant them as soon as you can, right after, as you're renovating, just replant them.
Makes sense to me. Thank you very much for that question. Let's take a phone call from Tom and Solman next. Tom, hello to you.
Hello?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Last year we had a basement put underneath our cottage, and they removed, they put a lot of sand and gravel from underneath it. I lost all my topsoil, and I had some topsoil hauled in, and before I spread that, I was wondering if I should mix or add compost. I have access to that as quite a bit of trucking it would do, but I think that, you know, that might hold some moisture in there. or is that too much nitrogen, and it's got a lot of sticks in it from it's municipal tub grinding, so you never know what's in there. It could be evergreens, leaves, grass.
Sure.
So just trying to get your thoughts.
All right, let's turn to Jason Fishbach first.
Well, you're lucky that it's sand and gravel rather than clay, because that's going to allow the roots to penetrate, and I think it's a good idea to add some organic matter. The compost you get from municipalities may or may not be screened. It sounds like what you've got access to isn't screened, so you have the bigger chunks of wood and branches, and that's not that big of a deal if you want to spend some time after you spread it. I would definitely mix it in, you know, no more than about 4 inches deep. And you can just pick out the bigger stuff. Once you seed in your lawn, it'll just rot and disappear. If you do have access to screened compost and stuff that's well aged, that's preferable. But you can get by with the unscreened.
Okay. Yeah. I'd add something to that, too. Be sure that soil and whatever else is in there has been composted to the point where you will not have weed seeds germinating.
Right.
That's the worst thing you can do is have a new lawn or garden full of thistles.
And generally the recommendation is spread it, let it sit for, you know, water it, let it sit for a week, let the seeds germinate, all the weed seeds, and then you can kill them either by just raking it again or if you spray it out with Roundup, then you seed it. So you get that first flush of weeds and you can kill those because you're going to have some weed seeds in there regardless.
Regardless. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Don Kissinger, we've got some tree issues in the state, some good things, but some tough things coming on, too, especially with the emerald ash borer.
Yes, we in the last month, we had another find south of La Crosse in the town of Victory, which is basically on the Mississippi River, and across from there is the Iowa and Minnesota border. So I guess it's bad that it has moved there, but the one thing from an urban forestry standpoint that we're trying to get communities to look at their ash and inventory them and be prepared for emerald ash borer is that a lot of communities have said, well, it's only moving a slow amount each year. Well, here's a big wake-up call. Now it's moved 180 miles, supposedly, so it can be anywhere in the state, and really we need to be vigilant and the way that it has moved in the past is through firewood. So that's one big concern. But the other thing we need to do is be checking out our ash trees and knowing what shape they're in. And if things are changing, talk to your DNR folks or extension folks or Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that some of many of the outbreaks have occurred around near campground areas or other places where people have firewood. So I guess one of the rules is don't bring your firewood from an infected area from Illinois or from Michigan and drop it in Bayfield or Ashland County or anywhere else for that matter.
Yeah, I guess one of the things that the Department of Agriculture is trying to push is burn it where you buy it. So basically, don't move the stuff. And if you're going to camp somewhere, get it at a stand that's right by the campground, and don't be moving any of the firewood, because that is how, when it first started in Michigan and has gotten to Illinois, and we don't know how it got to Wisconsin, but that's typically how it's been moved, overland travel by humans, because by insect alone, it only moves about a half mile a year.
You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller with my guests Art Odey, Jason Fishbach, Don Kissinger on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're broadcasting this Garden Talk program from the Bayfield Pavilion in Bayfield, Wisconsin. To kick off Bayfield and Bloom, it's going on. It started this week and this weekend, and it's a wonderful Bayfield, of course, and this whole area, Ashland, Bayfield area, is just a wonderful part of the state. And I hope you have a chance to visit and to come up and take a look at the flowers and all of the things that are going on. There's so many activities. It's really, I tell you, for example, the Wednesday Week Weeders, a voluntary group of gardeners who maintain this beautiful park at the south entry to Bayfield. It's that group's having its annual plant sale on May 30th at 8:30. There'll be annuals and perennials, home and garden yard sale, and all those donations of plant materials and used items are obviously much appreciated and go to make Bayfield a better community. So we're really pleased to be able to talk about that. That's coming up a couple weeks from now. So, but in the meantime, there are a whole lot of other things. If you were here right now, you wouldn't believe the number of exhibits that we have here. There's a great Northern Native plant sale going on today, and so I've been looking around, reaching into my pocket, wondering whether or not to be purchasing a few things. But, you know, I got to check to make sure. I have to ask Jason and Art and Don if I should be hauling those back down south with me to 300 miles away. But we'll find out whether or not that's a good thing for me to do. But I tell you what. Stop by this part of the state. You're going to really enjoy it here in Bayfield. And if you have a question, you can ask it right now. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. I think we can handle emails. Can we handle emails, Paul? He said no. Well, don't email us then. Forget about the emails. Paul Quello. By the way, as our engineer who was here till midnight, I think, or so last night, setting up the materials here to make the show run. I want to say thanks to him and Rudy Listings here and to everybody else, John Munson, Dave Potratz, their board operator, Christy Taylor, our phone producer. So it takes a lot of people to put on a program like this, and it takes a great audience, too, which we have here today. And I know if you have some questions in the audience and want to ask, please raise your hand and John will be right there, lickety-split, with a microphone. In the meantime, let's take a call from Larry in Eau Claire. So, Larry?
Good morning, Larry, and good morning to your guests. My question is, I have a flowering crab that doesn't want to flower. It's probably been on the ground for about 8 years now, and all it seems to be able to produce is two or three flowers in the spring.
Well,
I'd take a crack at
that.
Yeah,
go ahead, Art Odie.
When I worked in New York many, many years ago at the New York Botanical Garden, we did all the composting for the New York Zoo. And consequently, we had all of the wonderful manure you could possibly want. And we had a year or two when a lot of things didn't flower because we put too much zoo, is what everybody said. So
that elephant manure is pretty rich.
So I would check to see that you're not over fertilizing it. That's one thing. And probably check to see that you aren't giving it an awful lot of water either. Starve it maybe just a little bit if it's just not ever flowering. Anyway, Jason.
Yeah, Jason.
I was just going to ask, does the tree otherwise look healthy?
Yes, it does.
Okay. Maybe too much fertilizer then, maybe, huh?
It sounds like it. Otherwise, remember, those flower buds are actually formed the last summer. So if the tree was under some sort of stress last summer, it wouldn't have set flower buds. So if the tree is in a bad spot, so it's too wet with the ground, or if the temperatures perhaps over the winter were too cold, but usually flowering crabs are okay, or if it was too dry.
Or if you pruned it at the wrong time.
Right.
All those things. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Marilyn in South Range, we go to you next. Hi, Marilyn. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you. I've got a weed problem, and the things are called horsetails, and they were in a former strawberry garden, which I have to move because I think we have some type of virus or something in the soil. But I also have something that looks like horsetails.
Horsetails.
Do you know what
they are? Oh, probably. Art, do you want to take a crack first?
Yeah, that's a non-flowering plant that is very ancient in its origin. And unfortunately, they survived the Jurassic period and came down to us. And I think they're terribly difficult to get rid of. They're like quack grass. They have runners all over the place, and you really have to be very diligent about digging up each and every runner. But if you really keep at it, and Jason might have a herbicide that he would recommend, but if you really keep at getting rid of it, and are very diligent, in a couple of years
you'll see some results.
Some results.
Yeah, Jason, you comment?
No, I think Art's got it. It's with any of these perennial weeds, you just have to keep at it and keep at it. If it's a small enough plot, then that's feasible. If it's, you know, your whole yard, it's then you might look at an herbicide option. But just continuing to weed it out and really grub out those runners, that's key.
Thanks again for calling, Marilyn. Appreciate it. Let's take a question from the audience. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Thank you, and welcome to Bayfield. It's
Thank
a
you.
Pleasure to have you here. So many of us listen to Garden Talk every Friday. My question is regarding pH, testing for pH, because we're all turning over our gardens this time of year. And rather, I'm being cheap about this, I'm just wondering, rather than going out and buying a whole soil test kit, can I just take a little litmus paper, shake up some soil in a vial, and test it for pH, or should I break out for the money?
Jason, what do you think?
Yeah, well, there's an affordable way to get a nice soil test done professionally. Those kits can be sometimes inaccurate if they're not used well, and by the time you go out and purchase the kit, it's almost easier just to send it into a lab. So the University of Wisconsin does offer lab testing. You can do a garden soil for $15, and that's going to give you pH, the phosphorus, potassium, and organic matter of your soil, all of important numbers for your garden. And it's worth it. You do it one time, usually that sample will give you good enough information over a four-year period. So that's what I recommend.
So it's about $4 a year, thereabouts. Do the math that way.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for that question. And let's go to Nancy in La Crosse. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, and happy birthday, Larry. You and I share the same birth date.
Ooh, cool.
Yeah.
Were you born on Mother's Day, too?
No.
I was here. I was born. It was Mother's Day. What a gift for Mom, eh?
Yeah, really. Congratulations and happy belated birthday. But I do have a question that, and I've been searching my numerous garden books, and I'm not finding what I need, and maybe online, if your experts could point me to a good source. I spilled a seed packet of flower seeds all over, and I'm trying to figure out what seedlings are actually flower seedlings versus weeds, and I cannot find a good source that shows me what various flower seedlings look like. So I'm just hoping that the experts can point me to a good source that would show me what it looks like.
Well, I tell you what, let's Jason, what do you think?
The key there is you want to get a guide that shows you the cotyledons. So those are the first leaves that come out of the ground, not the first true leaves, but the first leaves. And that usually you can figure out what's what just looking at the cotyledons. And you can do it early in the spring so you know what to hand weed. If you go through the internet search and you look for weed seed cotyledons, cotyledons, if you got that, there's a University of Minnesota guide that I've used with my Master Gardener class that does a good job. It's a key that'll walk you through that. So if you Google that or do any sort of search engine for it, that's where I would start. Then if you have trouble, you could look for the weed seed or the cotyledon identification for some of our most common weeds, because most likely that's what you've got, something like lamb's quarters, and you can find those cotyledons. That's what I'd recommend.
Okay, thanks a lot for calling. And Penny in Eau Claire, I think you've got a question for us. Might have something for Don here. Let's go to Penny. Hi, Penny.
Hi there. So glad to see you're in Bayfield, wonderful part of the world.
It is.
We have some land up in Sawyer County, very close to Bayfield County. Cleared it off, and the aspen keep coming up. How can we, I know there's some kind of chemical, if you cut off the aspen tree and you brush it on the little stump there, it won't come up from the root again. What is that chemical?
Yeah, that's what aspen do, isn't it, Don? When you clear an area, that's what happens.
I guess in the fall of the year, I would recommend maybe using Roundup and dabbing it on where you have cut that. That may take care of the problem for you.
And don't you, when you cut, it's got to be, what, 30 seconds or so or a minute or so within the cut as you should be making that application?
You want to do it as soon as possible, and you want to do it when it's going to be somewhat of a drier day, not when it's rainy, not high humidities.
Yeah. That help you out, Penny?
Very good.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's see. Oh, John's got another question from the audience here.
Hi, I'm Diana. I live here in Bayfield. I'm wondering what soil additive other than bone meal I can put on my garden. I want to balance the nitrogen, the phosphorus, and the potash, and I have manure and I have wood ashes to put on the garden, but I'm hesitant to use bone meal. Is there something else I can use?
Jason Fishbach, what do you think?
Have you done a soil test recently?
Not recently.
I knew you were going to say that.
I would always start, and this is what I drill into the master gardeners, always start with a soil test. And I'll tell you personally, it's so hard to do. You know I need to go out and test the soil, and for some reason it never happens. But start there. I think you'd be surprised. Most garden soils have way more than a phosphorus than they need, especially if you've been adding any wood ash over the years. P and K tend to go up, and you probably don't need much additional fertilizer.
The garden's been fallow for 3 years.
Okay.
And we're going to till it all under again and try and get it back up and running.
Start with the soil test, and then you can contact your extension agent. We can look at some options to see if you even need to add anything.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for that question. And we'll go back to the phones. And Lisa in Menasha. Hi, Lisa.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, you were talking about the ash emerald borer, and I'm wondering how far does that insect fly or go from tree to tree, and if it's possible to make some kind of, like a fire line of getting rid of some ash trees that it would save the ash trees.
Well, that's what they tried in Michigan, wasn't it, Don Kissinger?
Yeah, and actually, to give Michigan some credit. When it was first found in 2002, they did not realize that actually emerald ash borer had been there for 7 years prior, or probably 9 years prior. And what happened actually is they were finding what's called outliers. So areas 40 miles away, 80 miles away, 100 miles away, where all of a sudden they're finding EAB again. And that's because people were cutting these trees down, not knowing why they died, and bring them to their second homes or cabins and that kind of stuff. So that has been tried. And I don't want to say that it's taken totally out of the toolbox, but unless it's found in an area where they can delimit or know the extent of how far it is, and it's in a small enough area, and they know that there is not a lot of ash or there's a lot of other trees around there, eradication has cost a lot of money and just has not worked. So if they jump on it right away, there's a remote possibility. In Wisconsin, we found that in the West Bend area, actually Newburg, that site had emerald ash borer for about 5 years prior. We just found out in the Victory site in southwestern Wisconsin, the same thing, it had been there 5 years prior. So when we found that, we found that there was a railroad area. It had been moved up and down that from rail cars. So when it starts moving radially, just like if you threw a pebble in the water, it's pretty dang hard and a lot of money and a lot of effort, and it just isn't working.
How do I take care of my ash tree that I do have to keep it, safe?
Well, there are ways to treat it. If you were asking this question a couple years ago, I would say that we don't have any proven methods of chemical treatments, and still we're kind of learning as we go. But there is a chemical that you can get at your local hardware store or your nursery, and it's called a Bayer Advanced Tree and Shrub Insect Control. And that's something that you could get and do what's called a basal drench, putting it around the trunk and the root system of your tree. And that's something that homeowners can get. If you want to get more technical, get into injections, I would contact an International Society of Arboriculture certified arborist and have them look at your trees.
Now, I'm told that in some areas, at least some areas of the state, they're asking people just to, if you've got a 2-inch or a 3-inch diameter ash tree, cut her down and put something else in its place before you get too fond of it.
And that's there's potential for that. I know in communities, preemptively, some communities are doing that. Also, I had a question from a lady from Iron River up here who she planted an ash tree. It's, I think, 5-7 years old. It's doing wonderfully. And I asked her how many ash are naturally around there, and she said that there really aren't a lot. So in a situation like that, you may be okay because naturally it's not going to progress because if you have other tree species around there, you know, the likelihood of it affecting that one ash tree in that area is somewhat remote. But in our urban areas where we have a lot of ash trees, up to a quarter of the population of the street trees and even more on residential, that is a tough situation.
Thanks again for that question, Lisa. Let's take another question from the audience.
I live in Bayfield County, and we're in an area that the DNR fondly refers to as kind of deer central. And we have an area that's about the size of a football field. And other than fencing or using the sprays, is there anything out there, maybe some new products or techniques that could be used to get rid of some of the brown government cattle?
Well, let's see. Who are we going to turn to? For Art Odie, let's go to you first.
Well, deer are, everyone knows that deer are just a terrible problem. I have heard of a new repellent that I have not used, and I can't think of the name of it at the moment. Jason, do you know? Is
there a new one out there?
Yeah.
You might be talking about plant skid.
Don's shaking his head.
Well, I've used that, and it does work well. And as long as you have a full day of dryness, it'll last the whole season, even through rains. It is, as far as working with it and getting it on you, it is nasty as far as its smell. But it does work well.
And it's lasted you a whole season?
It has lasted a whole season.
Generally, the recommendation is even if things like plant skid, eventually the deer get used to it, figure it out. So the thing to do, and what our wildlife specialists with Extension say, is do everything and do it at different times that you can think of. So if you have dogs, if you've got these various repellents you can use, if you've got scare eyes, you know, you've probably heard all the tricks that people have. They all work for a little while. So you just mix and match and try to keep the deer off guard. Other than that, the only foolproof thing that has worked is a big, stout fence,
Yeah. Unfortunately.
I guess another thing, if you are using plant skid, it's important to put it on the terminal leader or terminal buds because that's typically where the deer are going to go to first. So if that is unpalatable to them, that tends to keep them from the remainder of the trees.
There is a fencing method that I have seen. And I'm going to ask the other panel members here whether they have seen it. But I saw it out east years ago, and to my knowledge it worked, but I've never seen it used here. And that is to take two short fences and put them parallel about 3 feet apart, and deer won't jump because deer do not have binocular vision. They have a very flat vision panel, if you want to use that word, and they won't jump if they think they can't make that distance. And I have seen it, and it seems to work. Has anybody else
seen that? Have you seen that? Seen that?
I'm unaware of that, but try it.
Yeah, I've seen it, and it does seem to work. It's just like any fence, you've got to maintain it. Eventually, someone might try it, a bear or a deer, and then they mess it up, right, because they get tangled in it. The other thing, if you're going to use those types of fences, they tend to be electrified, so you put a lot of current through it and bait it with peanut butter. Put peanut butter on the wire. They come and they test it, and then they learn.
Yeah.
And that tends, so you're training those deer, basically, is what you're doing. But again, you've got to mix and match your repellent methods.
Turn off the juice before you put the peanut butter on. Thanks for that call. Let's take another question from the audience.
I have deer problem, but I don't do it anymore because it's just a big headache. They say, and it has worked, human urine around your trees.
Well,
you can only drink so much water in a day, though.
I've got to tell a little story here on the air. When I, with Calling All Pets program, a fellow called us from North Carolina and said, you know, I heard you talking about scent marking and how animals scent mark. He said, I've had this bear coming around to my bird feeders and eating up all the bird seed. So he said, I got my ladder out, and he said, I went around to the trees, and I'd climb up about 6 feet, and then I'd go on the tree. And he said, I did that on several trees, figuring that the bear would come by and see that, smell that way high and say, oh, that's a big bear. I'm getting out of here. You think that'll work, he said. And we said, well, don't know. But let us know. And he never let us know. Maybe the bear got him. I don't know. At any rate, what about human scent?
Well, they've tried, hanging human hair that you collect from the barbershop. And that, you know, as Jason said before, those things work for a while, and then the deer see that there's no other problem that's associated with it, and
they're
they ignore it.
Yeah. So there you have it. We'll take some more calls now. Vicki and Morrison, your turn. Hi, Vicki.
Hi. I originally said I had one question, but I have two quick questions, actually.
Uh-oh. Okay.
One is about tulips. My tulips have produced real good for me the last couple years, but this year they didn't do so well, and I know the soil test thing. But what type of fertilizer would be probably best to use? And then the other one is about iris borer in
iris
the woods.
Borer?
And yep, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, you have iris borer problems?
Yes, I do.
Okay. All right, well, let's start with Jason here. Jason Fishbach?
Well, with the tulips, fertilization to keep that bulb healthy over the years is important, and generally you can buy a bulb fertilizer, and the recommendation is to fertilize right when you see the green poking out of the ground, and then again when it's done blooming. And that post-bloom fertilization is probably the most important, because remember, that green growth has got to be there all year to recharge that bulb for next year. So if you cut off that green leaf, you're going to starve that bulb. So if you give it some nice food and keep the leaf there, you're going to have a healthy bulb for a while. Plus, tulip bulbs don't always last that long. 2 or 3 years is generally pretty good.
What about that iris borer? If you got an iris borer, what do you do? That's a problem, isn't it? That's a real problem.
I'm not going to answer that.
What do you think, Jason?
Well, I'm going to have to punt on that one. I'm not exactly sure. If you go through the university resources, you can get to the plant pathology website, and they've got fact sheets on basically every pest, and it's fairly simple to get to that website. And with the fact sheet, you can figure out, one, to make sure you're identifying it right, and two, what are some control methods. So it's the University of Wisconsin Extension, entomology website.
UW Extension Entomology, Phil Pelletieri's website, as a matter of fact. There'll be something on there, but I know they're a devil to kind of to get rid of. And let's see. Let's go to a question from the audience. Let's take a question from the audience.
Yes, thank you. We live in Bayfield, and we are beginning gardeners. And we plant mainly native plants and don't really want a fussy a garden or anything. But in the meantime, we have this wonderful new Labrador puppy. And in the winter, she has made great big yellow spots. Over the winter, she's made yellow spots in our lawn, which isn't all that horrible, but we would like a green lawn if possible. And what kind of grass or clover is more resilient than our Heinz's 57 variety grass? Thank you.
Probably the Heinz 57 works pretty good, but I as good as anything, but more than anything, we might need a heavy dose of water on those spots. Art Bodie?
Yeah, that's the old standby, and I think that probably is your solution. Just be sure that if you see the dog going on the lawn, get out there with a hose or a sprinkling can and wash it down.
My good friend and colleague Patricia McConnell always recommends teaching the dogs to go in one spot. So she has the dogs go in one spot in the corner of the lawn, and they always go in that one spot. it's kind of in the corner away from everybody. And if you can train them to do that, that's the way to go.
We should step back to what's causing the problem there, what's killing the grass. It's too much nitrogen in that spot. And so you'll notice at the edge of that circle, the grass looked really nice and lush. And that's because the concentration of nitrogen is a little less at the edge of the circle. So the grass does great there, but in the middle it burns it out. So by watering it, you're diluting that nitrogen.
Now, Thanks for that question. And let's take a, well, we'll take some more calls here. But just to remind you, we are recording from the Bayfield Pavilion in Bayfield, Wisconsin, to kick off the 7th annual Bayfield in Bloom celebration. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, Art Odie, who is a former chair of Bayfield in Bloom, a horticulture landscaper and expert in botanical gardens and arboretums, Jason Fishbach, the Ashland-Bayfield County Extension Ag Hort Agent, and Don Kissinger of Wausau, the West Central Regional Urban Forestry Coordinator for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A great audience here at the Bayfield Pavilion in Bayfield, Wisconsin, for this edition of Garden Talk. They're asking great questions, and we've heard some great questions from those who have called in as well. So if you have a question you want to phone in, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, and we'll take another call here. Let's go to Cher in Chautauqua. Hi, Cher. Thanks for calling.
Good morning.
Morning.
I always listen to you. I'm going to enjoy you on Saturday morning, but I'll miss the pets. But my question, a couple of them. One is, we've got some ash trees on the farm up here that, in the yard part, and am I going to have to cut those down, do you think? And then my second question has to do with maples. We cut a boulevard tree down in our at Chautauqua there by our church, and I brought three blocks home that went cut clear through the trunk, and they're about 20 inches high and probably 24 to 30 inches across. And in the middle of one of them was this hole, and I saw this white thing sticking out, sort of. And I stuck my finger on it and pushed back, and it was the biggest grub I've ever seen. It was somewhere mid-trunk of that tree. What would that be?
All right, Don Kissinger, what do you think?
I think that that could be a maple borer, and that does affect trees. I typically see that on the outside of the tree, and you'll see it as a like a horizontal line. And many times the tree grows over that. When you remove that maple, did you remove it because it had died, or was it living when you took it out?
No, the tree was living, but there were some dangerous branches that were hanging over the church. And I can't remember. I don't know if it had any hollow. If those branches were hollow, I think they might have been. It was a very tall tree, very old tree, I'm sure. You know, it was, I suppose, 60, 80 feet maybe. And but I didn't know anything about a grub or that kind of animal being in the center of a tree.
Well, that the grub is basically the larval stage of this borer, and there are many bugs in trees that you and I don't see that are just naturally occurring there. But that's what I think it probably could be is a maple borer. Now, you asked a question about ash trees, and I guess I'm not recommending to homeowners to go take out their ash trees now. And in some cases, you may not be wanting to treat your ash trees now. I know Extension was stating that unless emerald ash borer is within 10, 12 miles of your community, you really shouldn't start treating it because you may be wasting, you know, time, effort, and money. With the fact that we had this find 180, 200 miles away from our past one, I guess that's just evidence, again, that it could be anywhere. I guess the thing is, if you have a lot of ash in your neighborhood, that's a concern, and take as best care of it as you can, because emerald ash borer is going to affect trees that are declining if they have a choice versus trees that are healthier. But at this point in time, I would not be removing your ash trees.
All right. Thank you very much for that question, and let's turn to Steve in Portage next. Steve, hello to you.
Hello.
Hi, thanks for calling.
Yeah, now, I planted onions last year. I had a very good year. I pulled them all out, and then the same area where I grew the onions, it's coming up in bunches. Now, I mean, it was coming up green. I pulled it out, and it was like a bunch of little onions that I planted to get the original onions. So, one, How did those onions, those little onions start if I pulled all the onions out? And two, can I reuse those little onions for the this year's crop?
Well, probably didn't pull all the onions out last fall is probably one thing. But even though you thought you might have. Jason Fishbach, what about it?
I think you're right, Larry. It happens every time. You think you get all the onions out, and there's one that didn't grow that you planted, and you didn't pull it out, so it's growing this year. You see that with garlic a lot too, right? There's always a little one left behind that you didn't pull out, so you get a big clump of garlic. You can try to dig those up, split them up, and replant them. And now basically you've got it. A free onion crop, if you will. You give it a shot.
Sure, why not? I've eaten them in the spring, you know, when I've they look too good to pass up, so I just go ahead and eat them. Let's go to Pete in Waterford next. Hi, Pete. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a solution for the lady with the horsetail.
Okay.
I said I have a solution for the lady with the horsetail.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I take 50% solution of Roundup. I put a rubber glove on, and I put a cotton glove over that, and I just dip the glove in the solution, and you just wipe the horsetail, and you believe it or not, it'll get rid of it. It also does pretty well on poison ivy and other undesirables.
Mm-hmm. Jason, that's going to work.
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend you do it with a gloved hand. What I'd recommend is that's a rope wick application, or you can use what's called a sponge application, and it's basically just a sponge or a rope at the end of a stick, and in that stick or that tube is the Roundup solution, and then you can just go and rub it on whatever you're trying to kill, basically the horsetail. The advantage of that is you don't have to spray, so you don't have the drift.
Yeah.
But putting it on your hand, you've got to make sure if you're going to do that you've got a pesticide approved glove that you're going to wear. But even with that, I'd recommend you use what you can buy, these sponge or rope wick applicators.
Okay, that makes sense. Thanks, Pete. Jackie in Lake Como, on to you now. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, Larry. I have a sick apple tree that has been losing bark for a few years. I've been trying to nurse it back. It was badly abused before I got here, and I've come to the conclusion that it just needs to go. So I'm looking for suggestions to replace it and with something that isn't susceptible to apple tree maladies.
Well, Art Odie?
I don't think there is such a tree that's not susceptible. That's number one. Maybe. How old is this tree?
Oh, you know, I've only had the house for 4 or 5 years, but, you know, it's an old tree, and it was, you know, everything wrong you could do to a tree was done to this before I got here. You know, really bad pruning with 2-foot-long stumps left, and it was 3 or 4 trunks where the water could collect in the middle. So, you know.
How big is it?
It's about 20 feet tall, and, you know, one whole trunk has totally died off this year. It's blooming at the moment, but it's gotten progressively worse.
I'm, excuse me, I'm pretty conservative about things, and apple trees can live for hundreds of years. And if you have an old apple tree, I would try some creative pruning and see if you can get that into some sort of aesthetic shape that would be in harmony with the rest of your landscaping. I mean, that's just my take on it. I would fool with that tree and treat it well, and see whether or not it has fire blight that's causing the problem. See whether you can bring that tree back into some kind of good condition. You know, we're apple orchard country up here, and you'd be surprised how old apple trees get and how abused they are and can be brought back into some kind of shape. And I think Jason might want to add to that.
Yeah, Jason?
Yeah, you definitely, with the right pruning, you can get those back into shape. But another alternative for you, there are apple scab-resistant varieties that you can grow. There really aren't insect-resistant varieties, but something like any variety name with a free, Jonna free, red free, they're all resistant to apple scab. Even Honeycrisp has got a little bit of resistance. If you do replant, I'd recommend one of those varieties so you don't have to worry at least about the fungal disease, apple scab. But if you're going to replant that same spot, you need to take a couple of years off between after you've ripped that tree out and grubbed out the roots, or just plant it somewhere else in the yard. Otherwise, you're just going to carry over some of the root-rotting fungi. But I think if the tree is, in, you know, you'd have to see it to really know, but if you can get the pruning and get the training under control, you could keep that around.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We're broadcasting today from Bayfield in Bloom, from the Bayfield Pavilion. Art Odie Jr., Jason Fishbach, and Don Kissinger, our guests. I'm Larry Mueller here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with a great audience at the Bayfield Pavilion in Bayfield, Wisconsin, to kick off the 7th annual Bayfield in Bloom celebration. Hope you'll go online and take a look at the website there. And Art Odie, who's one of our guests, can probably help me with that to find out all of the different activities that are going to be going on up here in Bayfield County, Ashland County as well.
Yeah, just go to the Bayfield Chamber website.
Bayfield Chamber of Commerce. You're going to find out all the information right online, because this is not the only weekend. There are lots of things going on over the next many weeks.
I think I'm trying to think if I've got the dates right. I think it's June 13th. Anyway, it's the middle weekend of June is our garden tour, which will have five great gardens on tour that you can visit and talk with the people that garden
that
in them.
Gardens.
And that's really one of our premier outings here.
So that's the middle week of June.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll get the proper dates for that, because that does sound like a great event.
Yeah, Kristen is shaking her head.
June 13th. Yeah. That's the day, that weekend, right? Okay, June 13th, that weekend, is another one to mark on your calendar. And in the meantime, if you got a question about the flowers or the trees or the lawn or the whatever, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Certainly, we're going to take some more questions from our audience as well. Let's go to Julie in Oshkosh next with a question. Hi, Julie. Thanks for calling.
I'm calling with a whatnot question from the long list that Larry just gave. I have a quaking aspen that has an ant hill near it, and the ants love that tree. They've been loving it for several years, and I'm wondering, is there a symbiotic relationship? Should I get rid of the ants?
Don Kissinger, by the way, is the Ashland Bayfield County Extension West Central Regional Urban Forestry Coordinator for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Jason Fishbach is the Ashland Bayfield County Extension Ag Hort Agent, and I wanted to introduce them as well again. And Don, I don't think the ants are after a tree that is a healthy tree.
No, and I guess I live in Marathon County, and I have property where there are good-sized ant hills adjacent to, I've got some jack pine, I've got some elm trees, and I have popple also. And so I don't think there's any correlation between species of trees, and so I don't know what the concern would be, really. How big is your aspen tree that you have?
It's fairly big. I have no idea. It's pretty big.
Okay. And is it near your house, actually?
No, it's about 30 feet from the house, maybe.
Okay.
Do you think it might be 20 feet tall?
Okay. Over 20 feet tall, probably 25.
Okay.
And this is a tree that you're particularly fond of, or you just have the question of the potential symbiotic relationship with ants in the trees, or... And I guess I ask that because in the whole scheme of things, quaking aspen in landscape settings near houses, once they start getting pretty, you know, of substantial size, which this one sounds like it is not, can be a concern because they're a short-lived species.
Don't tell me that. I bought this house in 2000, and one of the reasons I bought it was the 60-foot blue spruce in the backyard. And the year after that, 9 months later, we had this huge storm, and I lost that tree, and I lost a huge crabapple in front. And then the road crew who were coming along to pick up the debris ran over the tree on my terrace. So this is one of the replacement trees.
Wasn't it your year, was it, Julie? Well, Jason, Art Odie.
Yeah, I've got something to add as far as the ants are concerned. If you have, particularly if you notice the ants going up and down the tree, and if the ants really, really are connected in some physical way with the tree, you may have aphids feeding on the leaves of the tree, and the ants sort of act like cowboys and herd the aphids and they use the sweet exudate that the aphids produce, and that doesn't necessarily hurt the tree. It's just kind of an answer to your question: is why are the ants there?
Yeah. So I guess I wouldn't worry too much about the ants at this point. And thank you very much for calling, Julie. Appreciate it. Janie in Arcadia, your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello. I have a question about a European plum tree that has a wonderful crop of plums, but it has now developed for the past several years brown rot, and the plums rot before they ripen. What kind of fungicide do I need, and when, and how much?
Jason?
Yeah. First, let's walk you through what's happening with the fungal diseases of fruit trees. So they have spores that overwinter, and in the spring, they infect young leaves or sometimes the fruit, depending on the fungal species. And they need wet conditions on those leaves to germinate and infect the tree. So what you have to do is actually prevent that fungal spore from germinating. So you use what's called a protectant fungicide, something like Captan. And that's going to be the active ingredient in most of your fruit tree sprays that are available, or your compounds available through nurseries and hardware stores and the like. Just make sure you're reading the label when you use that. But what you'll find is you're going to be spraying that fairly regularly, up to every 14 days or so, well before you have, starting now, actually, before you even have fruit on the tree, because you're trying to prevent those infections from starting in the first place. So remember I said you've got spores that overwinter. So in addition to the preventative spraying, you want to get rid of those infected fruit. You'll see they're called mummies. They're on the tree. And if you only have a few trees, it's not that big a deal. But make sure you get rid of all those. Pick them or knock them off with a stick. Do a good job mowing underneath the tree to chop up all those mummies and the leaves. And that's going to reduce the spores that you've got that can infect the tree. So between the sanitation and the preventative spraying, you should be okay.
Thanks for calling, Janie, and appreciate your call very much. And we'll take another question from the audience. Let's do that. Hi.
Hi, I'm Deb. I'm in Ashland County. I have an apple tree question. I have a couple of old apple trees with lots of blossoms in the spring, but around mid-July, they start dropping the apples, little green apples about an inch and a half to 2 inches in diameter. And they never seem to have any apples that ripen.
What do you think, Jason Fishback?
Part of that is normal for a fruit tree. We call it the June drops, or sometimes it's as late as July. And it's just self-thinning because it has all these flowers and it's too many fruits, so they drop some. And that's okay. Now, if they're dropping all of them, something else is going on that's stressing the tree, and I'm not sure what that would be. But that's fairly normal that they shed a certain amount of fruit every year. Usually when they're no bigger than, say, a quarter in diameter or so is when they start to drop them.
So if there aren't any apples left, what type of disease might it be?
Yeah, it might be more of an insect problem, probably not a disease problem. So you might have what's called plum curculio. It's a little beetle that feeds on the fruit. It actually will chew on it, and it'll lay its eggs in the fruit. And if they get infected, sometimes it'll shed those fruit. You could have things like leaf rollers that are chewing on the stems, and that weakens them. It's hard to say without going out to see the tree. But most likely it's a combination probably. Let's say it's shedding some normally, and then you might have some insect problems.
All right. Thank you for that question. And let's go to the phones then to Arnold in Oneida. Arnold, hi. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question about some sumacs in my backyard. I have a large open field behind my yard, and then it kind of seems like the sumacs are growing into my yard from the field, and I was curious if I could get rid of them, how to do that. I'd like to do some proper landscaping or some gardening of some sort. And how could I get rid of those?
All right, how do we get rid of sumac? Art Odie?
Very difficult. Sumac spread by runners, and they can just go, you know, halfway across your yard or whatever in order to produce a new shoot. If you really want to get rid of all the sumac, I mean, then you're pretty much into an herbicide application. If you want to control the sumac, then if you mow the new shoots that come up far away from the main clone, that will keep them in control. Or if you're really kind of like in an agricultural situation, you could try deep plowing to interrupt the runners from the sumac. Sumac are beautiful things if they're in a large area and if they're as a background in your landscape. So I would think twice about getting rid of them, particularly since they are so hard to get rid of. Jason, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I think you hit it. It's generally with these perennial weeds, if you will, even when they're tree species, when they spread through the underground rhizomes or the runners, you've got to really look at a multi sort of faceted approach where you want to cut them in the spring and keep cutting them as they grow to starve those root systems. And then in the fall, if you're really trying to get rid of them, you look at an herbicide application to get the herbicide down into the root system to kill it. Otherwise, if you're just trying to separate the sumac patch from the garden, you could look at some sort of a barrier because most of those roots aren't that deep. So if you dig a trench between the two, you know, almost like a plow furrow, or if you're putting some sort of liner between the two, you can tend to keep those runners out of your garden. Mm-hmm. It takes some work to do, but it can work.
Mm-hmm. And thanks very much for that question. We did get an email from someone who said that Minnesota now has emerald ash borer. Article in the Pioneer Press today said that state officials discovered the EAB in St. Paul. I wonder how many ash trees are in St. Paul. And then there's an email on preventing deer predation. Someone said, plant chives among your perennials. Deer seem to be repelled by the odor. Maybe. But then another, wrap young tree trunks with plastic fencing, which is sold as deer fence by home improvement centers. That seems to deter bucks from rubbing their antlers on the tree, so that's something you might try as you get into the rutting season, probably in late fall or whatever. Try that. And Steve in Iowa, or is it Iona?
Iola.
Iola, okay. Yeah. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I have some young apple trees that have, for the first time, gotten some small tent caterpillar tents on them. What can I do?
Tent caterpillar tents. Jason, what do you do with them?
You've got them here in the spring, or do you get them in the fall?
Are you there, Steve?
Yeah, I could not understand what he said.
Are you getting those tents and that you're seeing the caterpillars in the spring, or are you seeing them in the fall?
Right
you
now.
You see them... Right now?
Right now.
Okay. If it's a small enough infestation and it's just a few trees, you could actually just go in there and hand pick everything out. Pretty simple to do. Otherwise, you're looking at some sort of a insecticide application. You can look at something like BT, which is an organically approved compound. It's a bacterial insecticide. And the only problem is you've got to get it on when the larva can eat it. If they're in their tent, then it's tough. So if it's just one or two trees, I'd just go in there and hand pick it. You might close your eyes and wear a rubber glove, but go in there.
It's kind of messy.
Yep. But it's simple and it won't take you that long.
It gets the job done.
Yeah, just spraying the tent will not do it because that's why they have the tent there, is to have a safe home for them in Haven. So I'm with Jason. I think just gloved hand and, you know, taking that out by hand is the best way. Or if you have a lot of branches there and those are some that need to go because they're crossing or parallel or whatever, you can just cut the branches out themselves. Do not, and I've had some people use a little fighter underneath that, and that won't do it because you're going to kill your tree.
But, you know, they're not going to, the tent caterpillars aren't going to kill the tree anyway.
They're, no.
It's going to look kind of bad.
Yeah, the only concern is if their tents are at the terminals or the ends of the branches, they can just stunt that tree for a year or two.
Yeah. All right. And by the way, you can join in with your question at 1-800-642-1234. And I think we have another question from the audience, so let's go there.
Yes. We like to garden organically and sustainably. And I am interested in having a recipe, a homemade recipe, for a weed killer, such as killing equisetum or red sorrel. What are my chances of getting that recipe?
Well, what do you think,
Jason?
Well,
I've got a couple of suggestions. Most of these are going to be what you would call contact herbicides or pre-emergent herbicides. There's really no systemic organically approved herbicide that I know of. So you could look at things like the corn gluten meal, which is it prevents weeds from germinating. It works okay. The other option might be a spray bottle of concentrated vinegar. It's not your household vinegar that you buy. It's a higher concentration. Forget the name of it, the brand name. And that works. It's what you would call a burn-down herbicide. So you spray it on, it kills everything that comes in contact. But if it's a perennial weed, it's not going to outright kill it. It's just going to knock it back for a while, which might be all you need to do is knock it back till the other plants fill in.
Outcompete it, sure.
May I add something?
Yeah, go right ahead, Art.
The lady that asked the question is Mrs. Carlson, and her husband is... Collins. Her husband is sitting next to her, and they have the most fantastic, huge garden in the whole area. And their bulb display this year was phenomenal. And they will be on our garden tour. It's worth coming up here to see their property. If they were the only one on the garden tour, and they're not. They're just one of five.
And Joanne's a pretty good artist, too. It's a pretty good artist, too. Oh, boy. Thank you for that question, Joanne. And Jim and Sister Bay, we'll go to you next. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Yes, Larry. I'm trying to grow organic apples, and I need any kind of advice I can get how I can grow organic apples.
You're in Door County.
Yes.
You know, one thing that I have done with apple trees at my house is when the buds start opening or just beforehand, taking Ziploc bags and cutting the bottom ends of those and putting those over the buds, and that's a very organic way. You don't have to spray anything, and I had wonderful apples that when I've done that. So that's one method of not having to use any spray on that, and it keeps funguses away and insects away. And by cutting the ends of that, it allows air to get in there because you don't want to get too moist. And what I do is I pull the Ziplocs tight up to the twig, and then actually I take a stapler and staple on either side of that. But that's one method that I've found that's worked well.
And the Japanese, if I'm not mistaken, we've talked about this in the past, they'll actually put that right around the apples. They'll put bags around the apples as they're growing, and the apples grow right inside the bags.
Yep.
And they get some phenomenal results. And I always thought, we don't have an apple tree, but I always thought, boy, that would be fun to experiment with on just, you know, even a few branches just to see if there was what the difference would be. Yeah. Thanks again, and we're going to take another question from the audience.
Okay. About 3 years ago, we began seeing a lot of box elder bugs around around our house.
Sure.
And they've decided to live with us all winter in the house. And I'm just wondering if they might be a cycle, running cycles, or are we stuck with them forever?
No, they'll be out of the house. They should be out of the house by this time, but... Jason, you want to comment?
Yeah, their population does, like most insect populations, it goes up and down. And I'm not exactly sure what it's linked to, but it does seem to be dry weather, drought that we've had up here over the last few years. So, you know, they're moving into your house during the fall. They're thinking that that's a nice, warm, cozy place to be, and they just overwinter in the walls. Then it warms up again in the spring, and you start seeing them again, and they try to fly out the windows and don't have much luck, and eventually they all either die or they move out of the house. But we do see that population go up and down.
All right, let's go to Karen in Platteville. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I have a question. I have a flowering crab tree and a pussy willow tree that has suckers that keep coming up from the base. I want to know how to get rid of those suckers.
Well, you're certainly going to get those that happening with pussy willow for sure, I would think. Art Odie?
Yeah. The only thing you really can do is to prune them off every year, those suckers that come up from the base, the flowering crab and the pussy willow. Just get your pruning shears out and go to it.
Other than doing that in the fall, you can also prune it out in the fall, right? Start there, and then, or in the winter, or even first thing in the spring. But then, right when they start to sprout in the spring, it can be really easy just to rub them out with your thumb, all those little buds that are coming up from the base, rather than having to hack out the wood at the end of the year. That can be a quick way to prune it, too.
All right, and thanks very much for that question. We got time for Jim in Fish Creek. Hi, Jim.
I have a rather simplistic question. I have a small area inside a fence that I hand weed dandelions because I don't like to use weed killer. Now, when I take the top of the dandelion off, you know, I eliminate hundreds of seeds that form. I realize that the dandelions are going to come back, but are they like biannual or do they come back every year?
Okay, thanks for that question. And Jason?
Well, they can be perennial. They'll keep growing, both biennial, perennial. It depends on the growing conditions. And there's not a lot you can do other than trying to get that taproot out of the ground. So you get those, dig deep and pull hard. If you pull with a little bit of a twist, they can sometimes come out as well.
But, you know, those little dandelion remover tools, that there's one that works really good.
Yep.
I can't remember the name of it. I need my wife here again, who has the fantastic memory. Well, I tell you what, I have remembered every trip that I've made here for Bayfield in Bloom. It's then the seventh year, and this has been always a wonderful time to kick off Bayfield in Bloom the weekend. And certainly I appreciate having Art Odie with us, former chair of the Bayfield and Bloom Committee, a horticultural landscaper, expert in all kinds of things, gardens and arboretums. Jason Fishbach is the Ashland-Bayfield County Extension Agricultural Agent. Don Kissinger, also our guest today. Don from Wausau is the West Central Regional Urban Forestry Coordinator for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And they've been with us the last couple of years, all three of them. Art's been with us for a long time, and Don has, too, Jason, a couple of years now. And I'm hoping that we have a chance to do this again with them, and I'm sure hoping that we have a chance to have a chance to talk to all the folks in the Ashland-Bayfield County area here in Bayfield every year for Bayfield in Bloom. It's a wonderful, wonderful event and really something for you to see. So there you have it. We're going to, just to mention, coming up on Monday, Flo Hilliard's going to be with us today to talk about the differences between how boys and girls learn. So looking forward to that. And also our grilling buddies, Mad Dog and Merrill, are coming back. So we're looking forward to that one as well. They're always a lot of fun. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.